Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Ursula Rudenberg, along with Patch Larbaum. Hi, Pat, and hello to you, the listener. Thank you for tuning into Local Talk.
Hello, beautiful listener. Today on Local Talk, we will learn how peregrine falcons return to the cliffs of northeastern Iowa. This is an especially important moment to talk about this right now. Bob Anderson passed away a week ago today. Bob made it his mission to bring peregrine falcons to Iowa, and he succeeded. Today we will talk with his collaborators in this effort and tell the story.
I'm looking forward to that. Bob is also a world-renowned person for the Decorah Eagle Cam with 343 million followers for that site. But as I understand it, the return of the peregrine falcons is considered by many as Bob's greatest mission accomplishment, and possibly in his own opinion, too. And it was really what brought Bob to Iowa. Alex Fejar from the Ames History Center and Keith Morgan from Story County Emergency will join us later in the show. But for starters, let's look at the weather. Pat?
We have a fabulous forecast for you. Today is sunny with high near 80. Doesn't get much better than that. There may be showers later in the week with highs in the cooling 70s. By the weekend, it should be sunny again, but temperatures should remain in the 70s and 80s. No better way to appreciate Iowa and to appreciate that every day is beautiful and precious. And speaking of precious days, let's talk about the life of Bob Anderson and his important work in bringing peregrine falcons back to Iowa. He died a week ago today. A public memorial gathering will be occurring this Saturday, August 8th at 1 p.m. at the Decorah Fish Hatchery in Decorah, Iowa, which is the home of the Raptor Resource Project, an environmental organization that Bob directed. We'll provide that information on our website for you in case you are thinking of going. It will be a momentous event. Peregrine falcons are a hawk-like bird with a four-foot wingspan. They were an endangered species that was wiped out by DDT in the 1960s. Their recovery in Iowa began in 1989 at Cedar Rapids, where nine young were released, and then they're following their nesting in 1993. This summer, there are six new nesting pairs of peregrine falcons in Iowa, bringing our total to 21 nesting pairs of falcons. 11 of the 21 are in cities. All new pairs are along the Mississippi River and all have a lineage to Bob Anderson's historic falcon work. Bob moved his project to Iowa in 1996 with the goal of establishing falcons on the cliffs of northeast Iowa. We wanted to share the story of how Bob brought the falcons back to Iowa. It is a big story. Interviews were recorded with the people who worked with Bob to make this possible. First, we'll hear from John Dingley, who stood shoulder to shoulder with Bob when the project was conceived in 1988. Let's hear from John Dingley of the Raptor Resource Project. John Dingley, welcome to Local Talk.
Yes.
John, you had a long association with the Raptor Resource Project, who's director?
I've been a board member since its inception in 1988.
And what were some of the visions at that time? 1988, there were a few falcons nesting in the Midwest.
In 1988, I think we had MF-1, which was the first falcon to be released and established in the Midwest between the Rockies and the East Coast after DDT. And her daughter, May, had just started breeding on a smokestack in Stillwater, the Allen S. King plant, Bayport. We wanted to put a box there, and there was a huge objection to that. They said, oh, you know, there's power plants, they pollute, this, that, and the other. And the birds were hunting from there, and Bob said, I want to go ahead, and me and some friends agreed. So we formed the Raptor Resource Project to do it, and we continued to breed falcons in captivity to place into the world.
John,
that Bob wanted, he said, you know, I've been reading up, there's a guy called Fox, Professor Fox, who's actually happened to be in Wales, and he says, you know, this professor says that these birds nest site imprint. Where they fly from, they imprint. And he said, we don't have any falcons where they used to be. For thousands of years, they nested on the cliffs on the Mississippi and other high places. And he said, the only flock we've got is a manufactured flock that's living on buildings and smokestacks.
And why was that? That's where they were released?
They were released in boxes on buildings, and so they would nest site imprint. And that was where they went. They would kill each other over a sight on a building or a smokestack.
Oh, literally.
And flying right past the cliffs where their ancestral home was. So our goal then became, well, let's put the Peregrines back on the Mississippi cliffs. And so this presented a big problem because a lot of people were objecting to trying to do this. It's, oh, the great horned owls will come down and take all the babies. And, you know, we've lost babies before from hackboxes, but these hackboxes weren't on cliffs. So it was, this was presented a huge problem, and we wanted to go ahead, and people were objecting. But in the end, we moved the project into Iowa, and we set up a breeding program in Decorah, well, near Bluffton. Several volunteers and myself converted this barn into 6 breeding chambers. So we had 6 captive pairs. So we bred as many birds as we possibly could, and we started the program in 96, 97. But then in 98, we decided we were going to breed birds to put on cliffs. But we were so short of money at the time that what we had to do was we'd say we'd breed 20, 25 babies. We'd sell a good portion of them to falconers so that we could raise the money to be able to place the other birds for release on a cliff. And we did a lot of research. We found an area where there were very few great horned owls, and that, of course, was in the Effigy Mounds National Park. And they said, well, okay, we'll shut that cliff off during the season for 2 years so that you can release peregrine falcons, which was a wonderful thing for us. And then, of course, the wonderful thing was these birds being released off a cliff. This is what they saw. This is where they flew from. This beautiful, incredible cliff, Hanging Rock Cliff, overlooking the Mississippi River. And it was amazing because in 2000, there were 2 pairs nesting on cliffs. One was a pair that we'd released, and another was a male that we'd released that had actually brought building bird, a building female, and he had coaxed her into a nest site that he'd found on the cliff, which was wonderful. So it didn't take long after that for the population to expand on the cliff. And that was the highlight of my life, and I think one of the highlights of Bob's, that we actually got the peregrines back on the cliffs on the Mississippi River, where their ancestral home. Incredible accomplishment of the Raptor Resource Project. And it was a struggle. It was a huge struggle, because a lot of people were against us. We had help from a lot of people in Iowa. Of course, we went on to this incredible Decorah Eagle Camp. It's a huge clout to us to have to lose Bob. But we will continue his work.
Well,
we'll keep this project going forever if we can to help birds of prey everywhere, all over the world.
Well, and thank you for that, John Dingley.
Amazing thing. When I look back and I go, was I really involved in that? Yeah. What an amazing thing.
You're a very key member and shoulder to shoulder with Bob Anderson.
Absolutely, yep.
John, it's just a real privilege to include you in this discussion about the Raptor Resource Project, and there will be a future. Keep stepping, keep looking up.
Thanks, John. We'll do that.
Thanks, John.
Yep.
See you Saturday.
You will. Thank you. Take care.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio, and I am one of your hosts today, Pat Schlarbaum, together with Ursula Rudenberg. We just listened to John Dingley, member of Bob Anderson's Raptor Resource Project and their falcon work in Iowa. Let's hear from another key contributor, Amy Reese, who maintains environmental outreach for the Raptor Resource Project and one of their top researchers on the cliffs.
Welcome to Local Talk, Amy Reese, and you're a member of the Raptor Resource Project?
Yes, I am.
When did you start?
I started in 1994. Bob was running a peregrine falcon breeding operation in Hugo, Minnesota, and I answered an ad I had in the paper for writing. He asked me if I could write a grant for him, and I said, of course I could, and everything kind of grew from there.
Oh, fabulous. So you're from Minnesota?
Yes, I am.
How many trips have you made to Iowa?
Oh, I can't even imagine. I think in May and June, I probably spend more time in Decorah than I do in North Branch. I've lost track.
Included with your grant writing skills, you have children?
I do. I have 3 children, ages 22 through 14.
And what do they make of this peregrine world that their mother is so enamored with?
Oh, we've had so much fun over the years. I brought them along on banding trips, so they've done a lot of surveys with me. They get paid $5 for each peregrine falcon they spot before I spot it, which gives them a little added incentive to help me out. They've held falcons. They've really, really enjoyed it over the years. It's been a lot of fun to include them in the work.
And when I think of Bob Anderson on the rock, there are images I've seen you rappelling side by side.
Oh, absolutely. He taught me how to do that back in 2003. I started writing, and he kept saying, well, do you want to do this? And I would always say, of course. And one time he said, I think you should rappel with us. And I said, I'd love to do that. So in 2003, he and a bunch of other climbers took me to a hole-in-the-wall bluff near Fountain City, Wisconsin, and that's sort of where all the fun began. I've had so much fun. He opened up a whole new world for me with that. In addition to the rappelling I do for the Raptor Resource Project, I now also climb for fun, and it's just been great. My first cliff in Iowa was, however, Lansing, and it's still one of my very favorite cliffs to rappel on.
Well, let's describe that cliff. I understand there were young that fledged there in 2000. They were the first that had fledged from historic eyries or nest sites of peregrine falcons on the river.
Yes. That is a wonderful cliff for a lot of reasons. The rock there is really nice and solid, so you're not worrying about it dropping on your head when you're down on rope. That's a cliff with a nest box. The falcons there tended to try to nest on a ledge that was accessible to raccoons, so predation was a huge issue there. And we really didn't get good, solid production off that cliff until Bob, Dave, and I put a nest box there in 2007. And, in fact, that was one of my very early rappels, and it was quite an adventure.
Could you describe a box to us, a nest box?
Yeah, I think it's about 30 inches wide by maybe 18 inches high, roughly. Peregrine falcons like to nest on ledges and small potholes, but they don't usually do, you know, really deep caves. I've seen it, but it's not as common. The box is designed to shield peregrine falcons from predators. It can be placed on a very steep wall. You use essentially a rock drill to hammer it in, and then you put pea gravel in the bottom for drainage. And that will not only help keep them safe from predators, it provides a level of protection from weather as well. You get very good production out of the nest box.
Yeah, safe from predators, and the raccoons are somewhat formidable. It's amazing what they can gain access to when you think of a sheer cliff and just a narrow ledge.
Yeah, I cannot believe the places we've seen raccoon poop. It's just amazing. Yeah. I mean, you look at it and you go, what are they doing down here?
Yeah.
You know, but the peregrine falcons will often cache food on a ledge, and we think probably the scent draws them in. Bob would compare it to chumming for fish, so they'll go after the prey, and if there are also younger eggs on the ledge, they'll eat those as well.
What is the site that kind of stands out with your over the years of your work with Bob Anderson?
You know, there's a couple of them. Maiden Rock in Wisconsin, just because it's such an imposing cliff, and Bob always called that the matriarch of the river. It was really one of his very favorite sites there. He and his son Jeremy had Bob's 100th rappel on that cliff, and he celebrated by banding falcons with Jeremy on that cliff. So that one stands out. Oh, and one more. I'm sorry. I keep going on. Aggie's Bluff. Bob was so thrilled when that came online. It's north of Lansing, just a little bit. And he was so excited when it came online. It's a smaller cliff face. It's also one that, because of some technical issues, we haven't been able to reach. And at first he was a little bummed out about that, but then he got really excited because he said, you know, this really was my goal all along. And we've had fantastic production off that cliff, too. It came online, I think, 3 years ago, and it's just been wonderful.
It's on public land. There is a pull-off. However, the adults are not banded. Each of the young are not able to be banded. Bob, I've heard Bob call it the real McCoy.
That's exactly how he felt about it. And even we weren't banding there, when he would do his river surveys, he always stopped at Aggie's and checked it out. It just really delighted him.
Oh, I really encourage our listeners to check that out also, is where I essentially made a pilgrimage on Tuesday.
Oh, wonderful.
I heard young kecking. Never got any in sight. And they like to go down to that Wisconsin bridge in Lansing, the old metal bridge. And and later in the day, that's where I heard some kecking there also. So it's the calls have returned to the Mississippi Flyway. Anything else you'd like to include your thoughts today?
You know, this is really hard on everybody. We all really admired Bob. Certainly he was my boss, but he was, as he was to so many people, a mentor, a friend, somebody we looked up to, somebody who who really made a difference. And one of the things he would always say is, we can make a difference. He founded the Raptor Research Project not only to save the peregrine falcon, although, of course, that was his biggest goal, but also because he felt a lot of conservation messages focused too much on doom and gloom, and he wanted people to see that they could do stuff that would really change things for good. And that's, there are so many ways to talk about his legacy and the things that he did, but I just think that's so important for people to know that he just absolutely believed that people could and needed to make a positive difference in the world.
There was a precedent when DDT was banned in 1972 that he would refer to. Do you recall those conversations? If we could do it then, nothing was more formidable than removing the DDT from the environment. And he thought, if we can do that, we can do anything. We just have
Absolutely.
Well, Amy Reese, what a pleasure, what a privilege to have you included in our documentary of the return of peregrine falcons to the flyway. Thanks again.
Okay. Hey, thank you. I really appreciate this.
Yeah, thanks. And look forward to catching up to you, Amy.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio, where we are honoring the work of Bob Anderson, director of the Raptor Resource Project. Bob died last Monday. He is well known internationally as the father of the Decorah Eagle Camp, but his greatest gift to Iowa is his project to return peregrine falcons back to our state. I wanted to add one more person's voice to this tribute. Let's hear from John Stravers, a hawk researcher from Harpers Ferry, Iowa. Harpers Ferry is in Bob's beloved Driftless area, the area of northeastern Iowa that was not glaciated during the last ice age. In other words, the glaciers that flattened the rest of Iowa bypassed this region. The beautiful jagged landforms of northeast Iowa were unglaciated and remain stunning in their structure.
Well, John Stravers, welcome to Local Talk.
This is
this is a sad occasion with Bob's passing, but you're the man I think I was introduced to as. You were the hawk man, and you're in Bob's area of the Upper Mississippi watershed.
Right. While he was running around doing the peregrine falcons, I was running around doing red-shouldered hawks.
How often are you out on the Mississippi, John?
You know, during the season, during the nesting season, almost every day, sometimes that really from April to the end of June, really every day. But some of that then requires the work of cerulean warblers in Yellow River State Forest. Mm-hmm. But then that's just adjacent. So that's just a little bit up Pink Creek or a little bit up Yellow River. So pretty much during the season, then in the nesting season for the raptors.
Do you recall the first
about every day?
Do you recall the first time you met Bobby Anderson?
Yeah, it was at a meeting a long, long time ago when everything was still beginning. We were basically dealing with no population of peregrines because it had been extirpated, and it was just this effort to try to get it back. And so a lot of that was going on, I remember, at the meetings. But, you know, my association with him got closer because Kester became, I helped Dave Kester get started in the business, and Dave became Bob's right-hand man. So then as the time went, then I would see him often on the river. And, of course, with this recovery that's occurred and that Bob was the main instigator, I really think of him any time I see a falcon. And I'm always checking in with him and, you know, about, okay, what's happening with this pair? What's happening with this pair? You know, and he had so much of that in his brain and in his spirit. He just knew all these birds and all their lineage and who their great-grandparents were and the story that goes with.
Unparalleled.
Yeah, and the lineage of many of these Mississippi birds does go back to that work from 98-99 when he hacked those birds out at Effigy Mounds at Hanging Rock. And so, you know, the peregrines were in the cities, but he really was the guy who made it happen on the bluffs. And so these birds are on the bluffs now. And so, man, I go by them, and it's such a joy to have witnessed the return of these graceful and magnificent birds and to have known this guy, and such a sorrow to lose him. But I think we always have a choice to celebrate a life, and I think that's what this is about now, celebrate that life, that effort, and hope that this recovery of the peregrines goes on, and hope that people appreciate the falcons in the air, but also realize that he was a prime example of just going out there and doing something, to have a positive impact on the earth and the environment and on people, to get people to understand how important these things are. And wow, with an ego camp, I don't know that anybody ever on the planet reached more people with that thing.
Yeah, why are the peregrine falcons so essential to the Upper Mississippi Flyway, John?
Well, here we are in the Driftless. You know, I live in Harper's Ferry. I'm right in the Driftless area, so we don't get, you know, we're not flat like the rest of Iowa. And so we have these bluffs that tower over the Mississippi, and that was primary nesting habitat for the peregrines when we had them first, you know, before they were extirpated.
And so, when was that extirpation?
It started, I think, in the 50s, and by, I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, it was complete by, they were gone by the early 60s. I think the last nesting pair was here near Harper's Ferry in the early 60s. I have it in my mind as 62, but.
In that era.
And then, so, you know, and then Gladys Black and Rachel Carson and all these people reminded us, kept reminding us of these facts, what had happened, and you know, there's such a group of people, yourself included, and that helped get them back into the, you know, Cedar Rapids and Des Moines and all the cities in the Midwest. And that's, those sites all seem to be doing reasonably well. I mean, you go to the towns and cities and find peregrines. It's a wonderful thing. But then to have them back on the bluffs, that's have them really nesting in the cliffs as they should, and, you know, taking advantage of the populations of waterfowl and other birds along the river that congregate and give them a food source. And to just plain hear the echoing of these young falcons as they're learning to fly after they come off of these eyries, these nests on the cliffs, and to have that echo off the river and echo off that slab of stone that's 380 feet above the river and has been standing there like that for century upon century. Yeah. And so I think the stone likes to echo that call, and I certainly enjoy hearing it. And I don't suppose that any time that I ever hear one of those again, I'll not think of Robert Anderson.
Are you familiar with the bird effigies there at Raleigh Buckminster's?
Well, that ancient Thunderbird symbol, that's, we're getting into a big area there, Pat. A long time ago, the people of the bird clan, you know, roughly about 1,000 or 15 years ago, constructed these earthen images in the shape of the Thunderbird. And these were very meaningful. These took time, and they helped keep the clan together. There's a lot of theories about why these were constructed. And then, basically, the mound builders were, as the peregrines were kind of extirpated from the area. And so there's a disconnect in our understanding, but there's still something there in the spirit of those effigy mounds that had a big impact on me. And I think these things, when you go do the ceremony, when you bring yourself to that bird image, the one I usually use is in effigy mounds, and it's 190 feet wingtip to wingtip. And that's an amazing structure. And so there's something that can happen if you put your spirit in the right form when you go to those.
There's a pair of bird effigies. If you study them, you'll see the length of the long wings. There's one that's smaller than its partner. The smaller one is 143 feet across, and the larger one is 227 feet across. And Bob would like to point out that if you do the math, then the smaller one is the tearsole, is the male, at one-third smaller than the larger one, which would be the falcon. And you can't make this stuff up, you know. But
yeah,
it was through
Bob's
teachings that he noticed. He saw that.
We are lucky to have known him. We are lucky to have witnessed his work and his contributions. And like those of Gladys Black and others before her, they give us a shining example, and I hope there'll be some kids someplace who follow up in those shoes in some way, shape, or form.
Well, you got it, man. you're a piece of work.
All right.
John
thanks,
Strivers.
All right.
Again, thanks for all you do, and we'll try
good
to
luck
do
with it and keep at it.
We'll try to do Bob proud. See you. Thanks, John.
Bye.
Later.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio. I am Pat Schlarbaum, one of your hosts today, and we've been looking at the work of Bob Anderson and his passing last Monday, July 27th. There is a memorial to Bob planned Saturday, August 8th at 1 p.m. at the Decorah Fish Hatchery in Decorah, Iowa. We will provide information about the service on our webpage. We were just listening to John Stravers, a very key hawk researcher in Iowa. I will return soon to continue the falcon story, including the voice of Dave Kester, another of the four key people who made up this historic project to bring peregrine falcons back to our state. It was a team effort, and Bob provided the guiding light. His passing is a great loss, and there is greater inspiration to carry on Bob's work.
Thank you for bringing this story to us, Pat. And as I understand, you played a role in this story as well, that you didn't feature in the story, but you were one of the people that helped make this possible in Iowa. It's a big story of events happening and accomplishments that we witnessed in our time that many thought were impossible. Thank you.
Thank you.
Alex Vajar is here with us. He's an administrative staff and coordinator of various projects at the Iowa History Center, and I've asked Alex to come regularly to Local Talk so we can ask him questions in a segment we are now calling Why Is That? So here goes my first question. Alex. Hi, Alex.
How's it going today, Ursula? Thank you for having me.
Alex, why is it that the houses in Ames along Northwestern Avenue, south of 9th Street, don't face the street but are all set at an angle?
The short answer, the railroad. Of all things in Ames, what formed our town would be the railroad, and it has a huge impact on it. Now, starting back, we go way before even Northwestern Avenue, something I didn't know before I moved to town, but I just assumed that Northwestern Avenue was named partially because it goes northwestern, but it actually because there were Northwestern, Chicago and Northwestern tracks that went up that road at one point.
So the Northwestern is a reference to the Northwestern Railroad.
Yes, that's correct. And if you kind of pull up a map, you can see if you start up at 9th Street and follow where the tracks and 9th Street meet, follow it down Northwestern, you can see it kind of curves down right down to the old switch yards that used to be behind Main Street there.
So the reason why Northwestern is such a useful street, shall we say, to get from 13th Street down to Main Street is because it basically was going to the switchyard, which was the parking lot now behind Main Street. Is that correct?
Yep, that's correct. Yeah, it started back in the 1870s. A fellow that you maybe have heard of, James Callanan, who has a school name for him in Des Moines, built a narrow track road from Des Moines to Ames and wanted to continue it farther up from Ames to roughly where Jewell is today. But there was a town which he named Callanan after himself. And it had quite the reputation back in the day. It was known as where people go from Des Moines or Ames and go do their sinning. They had a lot of bars, and it was kind of a blue-collar crowd, railroad crowd up there. And so that's where people would go have their fun.
Wait a minute. You could get from Ames to Des Moines and Des Moines to Ames by railroad.
Yes. Yeah.
How convenient.
Yeah, right? Who would have thought? But so that town got kind of sprouted up as a kind of a place to have a little bit of fun on the weekends when you're done working. And it only lasted about 3 years, and then the town of Jewell was platted and kind of overtook it a little bit. But kind of an interesting tie-in with the James Callahan Elementary School down in Des Moines.
Okay.
And so once they built that, finally got it done, but that was right where Northwestern Avenue is today. Then we fast forward a little bit to about 1900, and they're thinking about a new depot for Ames. And the current curve that they had would have been too narrow for their now wider tracks for their big standard gauge trains instead of the narrow gauge. So they kind of had to loop it out just a little bit to get a little bit so they could slow down and make that curve without derailing. And, I'm sure the minute that the railroad took up their tracks and had a nice flatbed, I don't think it took very long for people just to start driving over it, a nice useful bed like that.
Uh-huh.
And eventually people would start. There were a few houses that would be built along there. Of course, the railroad still had a right-of-way for quite a few years. We see some maps from the 1890s still showing them having a right-of-way and after that.
So did the railroad go over the bridge that now goes over Grand Avenue?
No, that actually wouldn't be built until 1937. Mm. So we got to imagine that area is all flat. Mm-hmm. North Western Avenue as we know it today would have roughly still matched up with Main Street or Onondaga as it was called back then. But it would have just been all flat area, and there would have been about seven or eight tracks at some point there at its peak that would have been wide on Main Street.
And then on Northwestern, on the corner of 9th, between Northwestern and the railroad track that's there now, is a building that obviously is much older than the other buildings and is not doesn't look like the other houses. What is that?
No, that was originally built as a little community grocery store up there that we used to have, before the big Fairways and Walmarts. They would just have little neighborhood grocery stores. We could get all the little things you needed. And that took really good use of their very tiny triangle plot there that they had and just made the building fit as well as they could in there. So we see them using, they're kind of, as that neighborhood is developing and they're trying to make it into subdivisions, which were created about 1905 through the teens there as that neighborhood developed. They kind of took the Main Street square plots that they had and kind of transferred them over. And so instead of having the roads actually be the houses parallel on Northwestern, because if they would have done that and they started to build driveways next to their house, if they went far enough back, they'd start to creep into their neighbor's lawn because the subdivisions all go directly north and south on most of that block.
So it has to do with the angle of the railroad, really.
Yeah. And so everyone has kind of got a little cheese wedge kind of on the edge there. There are a few that it does get kind of straight. There is one house that is built on between 6th and 7th on Northwestern that actually is parallel with the street. And I looked, and that's one of the early houses on that block. And when I looked at it, their driveway did creep into the lot next door. So I'm not sure if they had to buy that lot, and it's a little bit wider. So I think they had to kind of do some fixing there a little bit later on.
Mm-hmm. So the houses on Northwestern between 9th Street and Main Street are at an angle because the railroad was an angle.
Yes.
And they were following the railroad.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And rather than kind of keep it towards the street, they had to keep in line with the subdivisions and the property lines from the east part of Main Street where it's all nice and blocky and square and perfect. But then they get up to this angled road here, which doesn't make it very nice to be able to do some easy math.
And did you say when it became a street instead of a railroad?
I'm looking at you and trying to confirm with the DOT right now, but I believe it's right around 1900 when they were building the new depot. They had to kind of reconfigure a few things over there because that line would have come in right about where some of the depot switch yards would have been. So they kind of had to widen it out a little bit to create the space there.
Okay.
And I'm sure as soon as all these houses came up, or as the depot was built, then everyone wanted a house near the depot too.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, thank you, Alex.
Well, thank you guys for having me.
From the Ames History Center, give your website.
We're at ameshistory.org, and if you'd like to come visit us, we're at 416 Douglas, and we're open in afternoons during the week and 4 to 10 on Saturday.
And you'll come again next month?
Sure thing. We'll have another question.
Okay. And can we invite Local Talk listeners to submit questions for you to answer?
Yeah, sure. You can find our email address on ameshistory.org, or you can email projects@ameshistory.org, and they'll go directly towards me, and we'll see what we can figure out.
Okay. Or you can also contact KHOI, and we'll forward it to Alex. Mm-hmm. But thank you, Alex, and see you next month.
All right. Thank you so much. Goodbye.
Saw me standing alone without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. Blue moon, you knew just what I was there for. You heard me saying a prayer for someone I really could care for. And they suddenly appeared before me, the only one my arms will ever hold. I heard somebody whisper, please adore me. And when I looked, the moon had turned to gold. Blue moon, now I'm no longer alone, without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. Mm-hmm. without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. New moon, you knew just what I was there for. You heard me saying a prayer for someone I really could care for. And then they suddenly appeared before me, the only one my arms will ever hold. I heard somebody whisper, please adore me. And I looked, the moon had turned to gold. Blue moon, now I'm no longer alone. Without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and that was Blue Moon, sung by Billie Holiday. We just had a blue moon, and I'm sure you saw how very beautiful it was this weekend. Pat, what is a blue moon?
Well, we had a blue moon July 31st, and there was a previous full moon on July 3rd, so it's the second full moon of the month.
Of the month. Nice. Okay, well, Keith Morgan is here. Welcome back to KHOI. Keith is Story County Emergency Management Coordinator. And we're pleased that you come once a month to Local Talk to discuss safety. Really appreciate you coming. We're going to talk about preparedness today.
Yeah, we are. Beautiful day like this, it's often hard to think about being prepared for disasters. But as we know, just south of us, they had a tornado just this weekend.
That's right. So it does seem like one more thing to think about in our busy lives, and the possibility of having to use emergency preparation seems remote.
You know, I hear all the time, you know, we've been through these floods before and we got by, and I can't afford to buy all of that stuff, or I'll just go to the Red Cross shelter. So I'd like to ask you guys, so why should we prepare? What, in your mind, why should we prepare for a disaster? Mm-hmm. I'm asking you guys.
Well, you know, I've been in a number of situations where things went wrong, and when nothing was prepared, it really turned into a disaster. And then I was in other situations where things went wrong, and there was a plan in place. And at that moment, the appreciation that somebody actually cared and thought about this is immense.
It really is.
Develop a plan.
Developing a plan, that's the first step that we really look for people to do, because most people say, it won't happen to me. But in this year alone, we've had now 26 tornadoes, one here, right here in Ames, on the south side of Ames. And mm-hmm. also, in my 4 years as Story County Emergency Management, we've had two presidential disaster declarations. So the first part I'd like to get across to folks is, it can happen, and it is likely to happen one form or another of a disaster.
So does it cost a lot of money to get prepared?
It doesn't. Just as we heard, planning is the first thing that we can do, and planning doesn't cost that much money. It's little things like learning how to shut off the natural gas in your house, because if there should be some sort of a disaster and it should create a leak of natural gas in your house, just as you were talking about, keeping the disaster down as small as possible is key. So if you can go out there and turn off the natural gas in your house, then you can protect your house, and it's not going to cost you anything besides making sure you've got the tool to do something like that. Another important thing is communications. If there's a disaster and if you've got a large family, you're going to want to know where they're at and that they're okay. And, you know, your kids are going to be at school, your wife might be at work, you might be at work, and one of the most important things is to have some sort of a plan. Now, do you think your cell phone's going to work during a disaster?
Probably not.
Yeah. They tend not to. Why? Mm-hmm. Because everybody is on a cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if you're trying to communicate within the disaster area. So one of the tips is to have a contact point outside of your community. For me, I've got a brother over in Janesville. He's one contact point. Another one is my in-laws that live down in Texas. And everybody contacts them and says, hey, we're okay and we're here. And then the contact point can relay that information back to the rest of your family. So again, it doesn't cost you anything, but it's the first steps to taking care of yourself.
You know, another reason why I think preparedness is a good thing is because it affects the quality of your life even when something's not going wrong because you have that sense of safety net. You know, it's in a way you've taken care of yourself, and it affects your life even when there's no emergency.
And that's another one of the things. When we talk to businesses and like that, when we discuss planning for and practicing for disasters, one of the most important things is to give people a sense that when a disaster is happening, not to just sit around and wait for somebody to take care of you, mm-hmm. but that you can take care of yourself,
right.
And that you've got some control, because that's one of the things that really gets people is being out of control.
And I like to know where my shoes are, especially like last evening with tornadoes coming in, and there's going to be broken glass, so have some shoes to put on and a light.
shoes, a light. Really what we recommend is folks to have a grab-and-go kit mm-hmm. that it's got a set of clothes in it. It's got your car keys in it. It has some vital documents, maybe a little bit of cash, so that if they're coming through and let's say it's a hazardous material, that's one of those situations where you might have to leave very, very quickly, that you just grab that bag. You take your family, and you have an evacuation plan, and they should be communicating to you where you need to evacuate to. But you'll feel a lot more comfortable, and you'll feel a lot more like you're in charge if you've just done a little bit of preparation like that.
Keith, on your website, do you have a checklist?
We've got some links on our website to preparedness. We have some sheets that tell you a whole list of items that you can pick and choose from, which you think are important to you. And, of course, they can always call us. Our number is 382-7315 or 7316, and we can work with people. If you've got an organization, we can make sure and get you some of our flyers so that you can hand them out and help your entire organization be prepared.
What do you actually do during the disaster to protect yourself?
One of the most important things is the first thing is, do I stay or do I leave? Making that choice is going to be critical, and that goes back to being informed. So first thing is have a weather radio, because the weather radio can also be used to inform you of other kinds of emergencies just beyond a weather radio. So you look those things over, and you decide if you're going to stay. Obviously, if it's severe weather, you want to get as low in your house as possible in an area that is well protected as much as possible, and take along that some sort of information. We've got battery-operated radios, weather radios. Mine is solar-powered, so I can sit it right there in the window, and I know it's going to be charged up, and it's also the flashlight that you're going to need.
Mm-hmm.
Shelter yourself and protect yourself from there. Then after you think that the main part of the disaster has moved through, then take situational awareness and, again, decide whether to stay or to go from there. Then you're going to use, if the water's still running and like that, you're okay. But if not, if you've collected that water, you can go ahead and have 3 days' supply of water, food, and medicines. Things like that are important to have so that you can take care of yourself until the structure around you gets up and running again.
And then what would I do after the immediate danger has passed?
One of the first things is to survey your house, and if you've been in your house, to see what kind of damages you've had. One of the most important things is if your neighborhood still has the power lines up above the ground, always be careful. Always be watching out for live power lines that might be down. So make sure you've got that flashlight and that you're looking out for those kinds of dangers. Survey your house. Make sure, again, that there are no natural gas leaks, no water leaks, that your house is still intact. And then you might want to notify people. One key thing that I'd like to stress to folks is also take care of your neighbors, especially if you have some neighbors that are possibly older or have special needs. After you've taken care of your family, go next door, make sure that they're safe and that everything's okay with them.
Okay. Any thoughts on recovering from a disaster like this?
That's where it's going to be key that you've got those vital documents stored someplace safe. You're going to need your insurance forms. You're going to need, especially if your house has been actually destroyed and you are needing to go to a shelter, you're going to need some sort of form of identification. So that's where if you've kept in a safe place a sheet of paper where you've copied your driver's license, your birth certificates, your insurance forms, contact information for your insurance company. That will be the key to getting you going back towards being back onto your normal life as much as possible.
So you want to take the time beforehand to make copies of these and put them in some sort of protective container so that they can survive.
I would have them in water. Your grab-and-go kit in mm-hmm. a Ziploc bag. I also have a set that's in a safety deposit box.
Mm-hmm.
I've also given them to, again, my family members that aren't in the immediate area mm-hmm. that I'm at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of those other things that folks might want to think about is if they have children, mm-hmm. do you have enough diapers to last 3-5 days or so, formula? Items like that that might be vital, especially when we go into the winter time when you may be snowed in for a while. If you have medicines, do you have a week's worth of medicine? Do you have a copy of your prescription for your medicines so that you can go in and get a replacement? That was one of the big things when we had an apartment fire here was trying to – it would happen on a weekend and trying to get people their vital medicines replaced was difficult.
Being prepared, it can really make the difference between a very complicated recovery or a relatively simple recovery.
It's never going to be easy mm-hmm. if you've incurred a large disaster, but it can be very traumatic if you don't have those sorts of things. It'll be very frustrating no matter what, but it'll be a lot more frustrating if you don't have anything to start with.
Mm-hmm.
Try to keep it manageable.
Definitely. Try and keep it manageable. One of the things is think about your whole family. Train your whole family, mm-hmm. starting with those fire drills to make sure that everybody knows how to get out of the house and then get to a meeting point so you know that everybody's out of the house. Also train beyond you. Make sure that the rest of your family knows how to shut off those utilities that are out there. Make sure that they know if you do get this bug-out kit put together, as we call it, make sure that they know where it's at so that they can grab it and meet you after you've contacted them for reunification.
And I see you also recommend exercising and kind of, in a way, rehearsing, right?
Rehearsing it. Mm-hmm. You know, contact your family by your communications network and say, okay, see if you can call down to Grandma and just say hi. This is just a test of our reunification plan, and I'm sure that Grandma will be happy to actually get to hear from the grandkids and everybody, you know, more than they normally get to. So
mm-hmm.
just little things like that. Build it into a bit of a game for the kids if you can so it's less traumatic.
Do you have any suggestions on that, how to talk about this with children so you don't frighten them?
It's difficult, but for instance, you're going to have your food in your bug-out kit or in your sheltering kit. Make it almost like a camping experience for them. You got to replace your food. You should cycle it on through.
Mm-hmm.
You say, hey, where do we have that food? Let's go down and get it. Let's see what we can cook out of what we've got down there, and let's do it without the power on to see how we would really do this if we had a disaster. And the kids will love something like that. It'll be a game to them. It won't be something that's scary.
Like a picnic.
It'll be a picnic for them, exactly.
Okay, let's see if I can remember some of the key points. First of all, you want to have a plan in place.
Yes.
Where you have talked to your family about it and possibly rehearsed what happens in a disaster. You want to have contacts with people outside of the area so that you've got somebody to connect with and for other people to connect with, not involved with the disaster. You have a kit ready to go with a bunch of things in there that are going to help you get through a disaster, including shoes and light. And then you have your important financial and legal papers in a safe container to survive possible weather, but also possibly in a safe box or with relatives so that they're offsite as well. How am I doing?
You're doing great.
What am I missing?
You know, some of the stuff like we've talked about.
Check with your neighbor afterwards to see if your neighbors are okay.
Exactly. And especially I've got a few in my neighborhood that I would want to make sure and check on.
How do you know when to evacuate and when to hunker down?
A lot of times that sort of information will be coming from the authorities because they're going to be the real experts on it, especially something as unique as if we would ever have a hazmat situation.
Mm-hmm.
We have a new system. It's called Story County Iowa Alerts that hopefully everybody signed up for on their cell phones that will work with those folks that are in charge of the disaster, and we can ring cell phones around there. And a part of it would be, here's where the problem is. You need to stay away from this area by 1 mile and go here for sheltering. And for further information, we'd probably would direct you to our Facebook site.
Mm-hmm.
So that we try and be specific. It can come out as a text message. So we don't have a whole bunch of characters, but we'll try and get hold of folks in as many different ways as we possibly can and provide them that information to get them where they need to be. So that's one of them. Staying informed, obviously, watching the news.
KHOI has emergency alerts.
KHOI's got mm-hmm. it. Whatever. Check to make sure that what you are listening to would have that capability.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, that weather radio, so if it's in the middle of the night that you have an opportunity to be alerted.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you. We're speaking with Keith Morgan, Story County Emergency Management Coordinator. Any last words, Keith, that we didn't cover?
Just like you said, they can call us at 382-7315 or 7316. Story County, we're on the Story County website under Emergency Management. More information there. They can go to BeReady.gov, which is the FEMA website. Lots of different places that they can get information.
And we'll put those links on our website as well in
Great.
Case anybody wants to check in with you and get some of the checklists that are very helpful
sure, thanks.
To this. And thank you, Keith. It's really always great to have you. And you brought a flyer here that's dedicated to emergency preparation for pets. So let's go into that topic in depth soon when you come back.
That'd be great. Love okay. to talk about that.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, this has been Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we look at the people, events, and stories of Central Iowa. We thank our other guests for today as well, Alex Fejar from the Ames History Center, and Amy Reese, John Stravers, and John Dingley. They are from the Raptor Resource Project, the environmental organization in Decorah, Iowa, founded and directed by Bob Anderson, to successfully bring peregrine falcons back to Iowa. Bob passed away last Monday, July 27th. There is a memorial to Bob planned Saturday, August 8th at 1 p.m. at the Decorah Fish Hatchery in Decorah, Iowa, Saturday, August 8th.
And we'll put a link to how to get to that hatchery on our website.
Mm-hmm.
Local Talk is aired today at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. You can also listen online to the show later on the homepage of our website at khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you can also find links to follow up on any people, places, or things you heard about on today's show. Remember that KHOI is streaming live at khoifm.org, so tell your friends and stay tuned to us when you're out of town.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop for volunteer reporters, as well as a radio show. If you would like to learn about reporting for the radio and join our team as a reporter, we will train you. You will learn and love your community as a result. We do. Contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. And of course, you're always welcome to drop into our studios in downtown Ames. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and check us out on Facebook.
Oh, and congratulations to American Pharoah and his owners for winning the Haskell International easily. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard Billie Holiday sing Blue Moon. Your participation as audience and your generous donations always make KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and we will see you again on the radio.
See ya.